Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose service to our country in variety of capacities in that war, in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps, notably, but also in our courts, it's hard to overstate its importance. His name is Robert Muse. He is an attorney by training and practice. He has co-founded with another extraordinary ally in the war for the free world, David Yerushalmi, the American Freedom Law Center, some 8 years ago now. It is an extraordinarily important organization helping to champion religious freedom and to defeat its enemies, notably those within the United States who seek through a variety of means to wage, well, lawfare and civilization, jihad, and other kinds of warfare against us. We appreciate him tremendously, both for his 13 years of service as an officer in the Marines, but also for the service he's now rendering in our courts. Rob, it is so good to have you back, and I want to say I understand that we are in a position to congratulate you on a rather important achievement in some of your recent activities in court. And we're happy to have you take a few minutes to talk about that as well.
Yeah, we had it was a first round victory, but a very significant first round victory in our lawsuit. Actually, we sued on behalf of the American Freedom Law Center. The plaintiff is my law firm. We sued the Michigan Attorney General and the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, who last February publicly announced in the context of our attorney general's creation of a new so-called hate crimes unit and the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights creation of a hate and incident database whereby they would be surveilling and collecting data on groups that are involved in so-called hate incidences. And an example that they actually used was handing out flyers during President's Day on a public sidewalk and encouraging anyone who knew the presence of an illegal alien to contact ICE. Well, that fully protected speech, but it's going to now land you in an official database by the government. But what makes this particularly egregious is that they publicly announced their reliance on the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate group listings. As I'm sure your listeners know, the Southern Poverty Law Center is a hardcore left-wing progressive organization, George Soros funded. You know, it's one thing for this partisan political organization to be labeling groups as hate groups as part of their private activity. But now when you have a government official, the state law enforcement official, our attorney general, and the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights expressly relying on the Southern Poverty Law Center. In fact, even in their public announcement, they put links to the so-called hate map of Michigan, which lists the American Freedom Law Center as the first of 31 groups that are apparently hate groups operating in Michigan and relying on a so-called intelligence report. So again, it's one thing for a private organization to engage in this political propaganda, but when you have the state's top law enforcement officer expressly relying on the Southern Poverty Law Center to make policy for the state, now our constitutional rights have been triggered. So we sued the Michigan Attorney General and the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights under the First and 14th Amendment in federal court in the Western District of Michigan. And on January 15th, our judge, Judge Maloney, wrote a 21-page opinion that supported all of our claims. He found that we had standing, meaning that they have engaged in activity that has harmed us, caused us reputational harm, that is created and fairly traceable to the actions of the Attorney General, and that it can be redressed by a favorable decision. And he went on further to explain that, you know, our claims under the First Amendment, our right to freedom of speech, our right to expressive association, equal protection, they were valid claims and the case goes forward. He made it very clear that there is absolute harm caused by the government placing its imprimatur on the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate group designation, which is a pejorative and harmful label that harms our reputation as a law-abiding public interest law firm. Wonderful decision. Granted, it was just on a motion to dismiss, but now it opens the doors for discovery, and it certainly shapes the battlefield in a way that we can see victory here at the end of the tunnel. So a very, very important decision by our judge. Very courageous judge. He's a terrific judge, and the opinion is posted on our website, AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org. You can just do a search for this lawsuit. It's one of the top press stories, and you can read the decision yourself. You don't even have to take my word for it. You can read his decision. You can read our press release, which we quoted at length his decision because it was so well done.
Let's just tease this out for a little bit. We don't have much time. I just want to say how thrilled I am, both for you as victims of this political warfare instrument, the Southern Poverty Law Center, as are many of us. I will say that I personally have been on their hate list for a long time, as has the Center for Security Policy. And I want to commend to you and to our listeners, I hope to have its author on shortly, Tyler O'Neill's new book, Making Hate Pay. The subtitle is The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Rob, I know that it's not going to tell you anything you don't know, but I think an awful lot of Americans, including lots of people in the media, who have continued to treat the Southern Poverty Law Center as somehow the paragon of virtue and the ultimate and authoritative arbiter of who is hateful and who is not hateful, continue to be deluded on this point. And I think what you may be able to do through your discovery, as well as through your further prosecution, if I may use that word in this case, of Dana Nessel, the Attorney General of Michigan and her colleague in the Civil Rights Project. This is vital work, and I couldn't be more enthusiastic to see what comes of it. And just a quick question to you, Rob. You said that this is a case in which a government official was expressly relying on the Southern Poverty Law Center as the source for their activities. But there have been many other organizations of the government, including the federal government, that have at least implicitly acknowledged doing so as well, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as I recall.
Yeah, they have. In my understanding, though, they have severed ties with the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, rightfully so, and as of late. And right. And the thing that's different here, though, is think about the context where this comes up. Right. We're relying on the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's in the context of her creation of this hate crimes unit, and in the context of this creation of this hate crimes incident, their hate incident database. It doesn't even have to be a crime. It just has to be even protected speech that they consider to be hate speech, winds you up in a government database. Nobody has gone this far. You know, this Michigan Attorney General is a hardcore left-wing progressive right out of the Eric Holder, mold. She is weaponizing her office. And that's where, so this is taking this even to a next step, right? I've described, now the Michigan Attorney General's office as the thought police, right? This is right out of a page of George Orwell. And so even though others have mentioned and perhaps have relied on some of the data, this has taken that to a step further, and it's taken it to the point where we are on this list, and they expressly said so in this press release they sent out in February of last year. So this is a very important lawsuit, and we hope to expose the Southern Poverty Law Center. And if we can show that there's enough ties between the Southern Poverty Law Center and this Michigan AG such that their actions might be considered state action as well, we will amend our complaint and bring them into this lawsuit as well.
I wish you the very best and good hunting, as they say. And I hope that this federal judge's deliberations on this case will also inform what's happening in neighboring Minnesota under the hands of its hard left Muslim Brotherhood affiliated attorney general, namely Keith Ellison. We'll be watching for you on that count too. Thanks so much, Rob Muse, for joining us. Come back to us again with updates if you will. We're very keen to hear about your progress. Next up, we will speak with Mort Klein about Jared Kushner's peace plans, pluses and minuses, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a great privilege to say we are joined by a man I've come to admire tremendously over, decades of work on behalf of our own country and Israel. Is the national president of a truly indispensable organization, the Zionist Organization of America. We had the opportunity to speak with his colleague Dan Pollack recently, and we're very pleased to welcome back Mort Klein. He is, among other things, highly recognized by lots of people, but I'm particularly proud that the Center for Security Policy was able to present him with our Keeper of the Flame Award a couple of years back. He has earned it many times over, and we're always pleased to have a chance to visit with him. Mort Klein, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Let me ask you, Mort, yesterday Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who was the principal architect, I think it's fair to say, of the deal of the century, as the president has branded it, the vision for peace in the Middle East, specifically between Israelis and Palestinians, that was rolled out recently. He is presumably seeking to get the buy-in of those nations on the UN Security Council, but I wanted to see what he's done to secure the buy-in of the Zionist Organization of America. And I've seen some of your publications on the subject. I gather there are parts of the plan that you're quite happy with and parts that you're not so happy with. Give us a sense of the plan and its merits and demerits, as you see it.
Compared to all the other plans that have failed, and they failed because, of course, the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian Arabs, will not accept Israel under any circumstances. It's really a religious war, not a law about land. That's why none of these plans have worked. But this reverses all the other plans. This plan is not land for peace. We give you land and then we get peace. It's peace for land. In other words, they're requiring, this plan requires the Palestinian Authority to become a semi-normal entity as opposed to a terrorist regime before there's any discussion of any concessions to the Palestinian Authority. They have to pass a law ending their program, which pays Arabs to murder Jews, and the more Jews they murder, the higher their lifetime pension is for these Arabs and their families, a pension which, by the way, is five times the average income of an average Palestinian. They have to disarm the terror groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the rest. They have to agree to permit Jews to pray in the Temple Mount. They don't allow it now. They control the Temple Mount, I'm afraid. And they have to show a long period of promoting human rights, having real courts, and having a democracy with real elections regularly occurring. They have to publicly proclaim that Israel is a Jewish state and we support as a Jewish state. They have to publicly condemn BDS. Do that. It's part of the plan. It's in the plan. And they have to end all further claims. So people say to me when I've talked to others, well, isn't this extraordinary? They ask these extraordinary things of them. I said, no. What this plan does is ask the Palestinian Authority to become a normal entity. This is all normal. It's nothing extraordinary. It's being asked just to become normal. Of course, for the Palestinian Authority to become normal is a giant step compared to where they are now. So we're very pleased that these important requirements are there. We've never had that before. As a preface before any concessions are made. But if they in fact make all those concessions in a sincere way, then they do get 30% more of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. They already have 40%, and they get a slice of Jerusalem, which they can call as their capital, and a state.
Now, is that Jerusalem proper, Mort Klein, or is that sort of suburbs of Jerusalem that are outside of the city proper, which is, I thought, still recognized by the United States government as the unified capital of the State of Israel?
Yes. The land they get in Jerusalem is beyond the security fence. It's Abu Dish, Shu'afat, and some other little areas, so it's beyond it. The rest of Jerusalem remains undivided. But see, I don't frankly, even though this plan is better than anything else we've had, and it's worthwhile, I don't like even, again, proposing any concessions, even though they're made after all this has to happen, to Palestinian Authority. I think in some way it should be said, you have a year to do these things. If you do these things, then we'll discuss concessions. I don't like giving the Palestinian Authority any hope that the world is still wants to make concession to this terrorist regime. That troubles me. But the way Trump does this is the best way possible that this could be done. There's also, by the way, a four-year freeze. Israel's not allowed to build anywhere in Judea and Samaria except the communities that already exist. They can build within those. But what's remarkable about that demand is Israel hasn't built a single new community in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, since Oslo began. So people think that you know, Israel's been building, now they're being stopped. The fact is Israel hasn't built in 26 years, except within the existing communities. That's something people do not realize.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has studied more closely than you the true nature, and spoken more forthrightly about the true nature of the Palestinian terror regime, whether it's the part that's doing business as the Palestinian Authority or it's the part that's governing Hamasistan in Gaza. The requirement for a changing of spots on the part of these guys, I think it speaks to your point about making further concessions or otherwise legitimizing these characters, unless and until they do undergo a fundamental transformation. Do you see any sign of such a transformation being in prospect? And how, if not $50 billion and the prospect of 30% more of the land and all the rest of what's on offer here, what is likely to bring about that kind of transformation as you see it, Mort Klein?
Look, they've already, as we all know, Abbas has condemned this plan 1,000 times, the way he said. He's already ordered a terror war. There's been now constant terrorism for the last few days against Israelis, against innocent Israelis. The only hope that they could do something is the fact that initially, surprisingly in some sense, Oman, Bahrain, UAE, Saudi Arabia, and even Qatar, has publicly supported the plan. Yet, when they went to Cairo, all the 22 Arab countries, the five Arab countries I just mentioned, backed down, and now they say they oppose the plan. Now they joined the other Arab countries opposing the plan. But, you know, I was at the White House when the ceremony was held for this plan, and the ambassadors from Oman, Bahrain, and UAE were there in the room. And I know that they and Saudi Arabia and Qatar actually really do think there's something here. Plus, there are a number of European countries, seven, which have endorsed the plan. And so I believe, and I've talked to many Israeli officials, they and I believe there will be great pressure on the Palestinian Authority by a number of Arab countries and European countries to sit down and negotiate this plan, make a counteroffer, but sit down and negotiate this plan. So there is some hope that something will happen in the weeks and months ahead because of pressure from countries in the Middle East, in the Arab world, and Europe, which previously would never have supported this.
But it is distressing that there has been a back away publicly at this point. We'll be watching this closely, as I know will you, Mort, and I hope that the United States government will be very firm with the backsliders, as it obviously was in the run-up to this plan's unveiling. Let me ask you, Mort, speaking of these settlements in Judea and Samaria, what some have long called the occupied territory of the West Bank, do you anticipate that Benjamin Netanyahu will establish the sovereignty of Israel over those areas in the perhaps run-up to this election coming up in March? And if he doesn't, how do you think he's likely to fare?
Even before the plan, he said he's going to establish sovereignty over the Jordan Valley, which is critical. Even the left wing in Israel says we have to have sovereignty over the Jordan Valley, or Israel is not protected by a potential attack from Jordan, which could, of course, happen in the past. Netanyahu has said that after the election, he will establish sovereignty. Gantz, his opponent, has said he'll establish sovereignty after the election if he wins, but only along with the international community if they support it. So he's a lot weaker on it. Bibi is a lot stronger on it. And the United States in this plan has said they will support sovereignty over all the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria and the Jordan Valley immediately after Israel passes a law to say they will do so. So I think there's a strong chance that will happen, but probably not until after the election, even though we have urged Netanyahu to do it immediately.
Are you making book on the election, third time's the charm for Bibi, or do you think this is likely to continue to be a stalemate that leaves Israel somewhat rudderless at a critical time?
The latest polls show a split between the right and the left, but the left, of course, includes the 13 Arabs. And the 13 Arab members of Knesset are extremely hostile to Israel. They are not loyal citizens of Israel. So among the Jews of Israel, the right of center has a far greater number of seats they'll have. But it's split, and I think it's possible if it's split that if Bibi gets the nod to try and form a government, I think this time Avigdor Lieberman will join Netanyahu and form a government. That is my belief. He's been put under enormous pressure to do so. He's made his points. He sees that he's lost support because his support in the Knesset has dropped significantly since he's been refusing to join any party for to establish a government. I think he'll do it with Netanyahu if Netanyahu wins.
Well, as they say, Mort, from your lips to God's ears. I pray that that will be the case indeed, and we'll be, again, watching this front closely too, with your great help at the Zionist Organization of America. You are an inspiration to all of us who love Israel and America, and I know that you will keep up the good work, my friend. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Douglas J. Feith, another of our duty experts on the Middle East, about the peace plan and more, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by one of our most well-accomplished colleagues and admired comrades-in-arms. He is Douglas J. Feith, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the George W. Bush administration, the author of one of the best accounts of what happened during that critical period entitled War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. He is also, these days, a senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the highly regarded Hudson Institute. He's always a welcome guest here, most especially today. Good to talk with you. Doug Feith, welcome back. I want to pick up where we left off with Mort Klein a moment ago, a mutual friend of ours and longtime colleague in the fight. Mort is a little skeptical about the peace plan that Jared Kushner presented to the UN Security Council yesterday, the president and Bibi Netanyahu and others unveiled with great fanfare. I don't know if you were there, but you should have been if you weren't at the White House when this was rolled out at the end of January. Doug Feith, give us your sense of this deal of the century as it's been billed by the president. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's widely misunderstood because I've read an enormous amount of commentary about it that says things like, the plan is going to be a failure because it's not going to produce an agreement. And I'm not sure that the people who say that understand the purpose of the administration in putting the plan forward. I can't say authoritatively that I know that either, but I gather from reading the plan that the people who put it together were not measuring success necessarily by whether it leads to an agreement. I mean, I think what runs through the plan is a recognition that a consensual resolution of the conflict at this point may not be possible because the Palestinian leadership that's in place right now has shown itself completely uninterested in terminating the conflict. And so the question is, okay, if you don't believe that a plan is going to produce an agreement, why put it forward? Well, there are a number of reasons why I think the administration had an interest in putting it forward. And one of the things they wanted to do was tell a number of truths about the nature of the conflict that previous administrations generally didn't give voice to or acknowledge. And so what they did here, I think, was, first of all, they told a whole lot of truths in the sense that, you know, they laid out realistic points about the, you know, the history of rejectionism by the Palestinian leadership, the lack of reality of the Palestinian claim for a right of return that would basically end Israel as a Jewish majority state, and the recognition that the Israelis, after such a long period of time of having to defend themselves against efforts to destroy Israel, are not going to take enormous security risks in relinquishing territory that's highly strategically valuable. So I think that part of what they were doing was making just correct observations about the nature of the conflict. The other thing they were doing, which is, I think, in many ways the most significant thing, is they were saying to the Palestinian leadership that there is a price to be paid for your rejectionism, that you cannot expect that if you refuse to make peace with Israel and terminate the conflict, that we're going to freeze positions in place so that you don't lose anything by your rejectionism. What this peace plan does in a very bold way, and bolder than any previous administration, is it says life goes on, realities change, and you are going to be worse off if you don't take this agreement than if you do. And so what this administration has stopped doing is they've stopped trying to woo the Palestinian leadership and say, we're making an agreement that is well above your minimum standards. They've given up on that because the Palestinian leadership has said that their minimum standards includes the destruction of Israel. So they're saying, we're not interested in your minimum standards. We're simply delivering you a blunt lesson, a blunt message. And the message is this: you can take this deal now, however unsatisfactory you think it is, and we're not trying to prove to you that it's great from your point of view. It's just the best you're going to get right now. And if you wait, it's going to get worse. And that's the message. Now, I'm not sure that that message is designed necessarily to produce an agreement. It's designed to shock the Palestinian leadership and community into a more realistic view of how history unfolds.
And create, let's be clear, disincentives to bad behavior as opposed to rewarding it, which is what the various peace plans have typically done in the past. And in that sense, I think you're right, Doug. It is a step in the right direction. And to the extent that it simply changes the whole dynamic from the past, even if it's being rejected at the moment by the Palestinians, it puts the whole thing on a more realistic and honest basis, it does seem to me, too.
And by the way, and if it does that, the important thing I think to realize from the administration's point of view is if it accomplishes what you and I have just said, then the administration can say it's a success, even if it doesn't produce an agreement. I'm not sure that the administration people are so unrealistic as to believe that this Palestinian leadership, which in the recent past has rejected deals that were substantially sweeter for the Palestinians than this one, is going to accept this one. And so critics who say, Trump failed with this peace plan because he's not going to produce agreement, think that he thinks he is going to produce agreement. And I think that completely misunderstands what the administration was doing.
Doug, you've studied this region intensively for decades and probably have as good a fix on its realities as anybody. It does seem to me that one of the sort of subtexts of this whole process, this particular initiative specifically I'm speaking of here, is that it properly calibrates the importance of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as it's called, in the great scheme of things. And it is no longer the centerpiece. It is no longer the determinant of whether or not, we have a policy approach or an outcome in the Middle East that is going to be, consistent with our interests. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on an enormously important point, which this peace plan doesn't, in fact, highlight. And that is U.S. policy for decades, going back to the 1940s and 50s in particular, when Israel first came into being, has been premised on the assumption that the Arab world in general, and not just the Palestinians, assigns the highest priority to the Palestinian cause. And the amount of priority that they assign has varied over time, but I'm not sure that it was ever the case that they assigned the kind of high priority to the Palestinian cause that American policymakers have generally thought was the case. And we've seen very dramatically in recent years, ironically, as a result of the pro-Iranian nuclear deal diplomacy of the Obama administration, and the ironic reaction to the Obama administration throughout the region was to push the Arab states, in particular the Arab Gulf states, closer to Israel in a strategic alliance against Iran and against America's Iran policy. And so we've seen in recent years very dramatically that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, the Kuwaitis, and others have been willing to openly establish ties, invite Israeli officials to come and visit, you know, host Israeli sports teams, make gestures to Israel, like allowing, you know, overflight rights of commercial airliners to Israel over Saudi Arabia. I mean, all kinds of gestures that a few years ago would have been unimaginable. Various Arab Gulf states have been making toward Israel because they assign much higher priority to the fight against Iran and what they consider to be the Shiite threat to them. And they view Israel as an important ally against Iran. And while I think there's still a lot of sympathy in the Gulf Arab states for Palestinians, there's a general view that the Palestinian leadership has been unconstructive, corrupt, and has not done a favor to its own cause and has not been supportive of the Gulf states in their main interests.
A very correct perception, let me just hasten to add. they're right on all counts there. And Doug, I guess the really critical point here is that all of that has survived the dramatic change in policy that Donald Trump has promulgated in rejecting this Obama bomb deal with Iran and putting the sanctions on and very strongly signaling its alignment with and support of Israel. This is a tectonic, you know, shaking up of the whole region and enterprise, and your insights into it and your writings often at the Wall Street Journal, Doug, as well as, of course, your masterwork, War and Decision, are deeply appreciated, as are your visits with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for today and a great weekend to you. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman about much of what's going on here in this region and beyond, particularly with China, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're privileged to be able to visit each week with our friend David Goldman, truly a Renaissance man who has contributed mightily to this program over the past few years, and we look forward to our weekly visits with him with great excitement. We're particularly keen because one of his areas of particular focus is Asia. He writes for the Asia Times under the pseudonym Spengler. He is the author of How Civilizations Die and of a forthcoming book about Huawei. And we will be talking with him about that topic in a moment. But before we get started, David, first of all, let me say welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us. Well, let's begin with the coronavirus, can we? I'm interested in what you're picking up from your colleagues reporting and other sources about the true state of the problem inside China, and not so much from an epidemiological point of view as from a political point of view.
I think that the Chinese government has used the situation to demonstrate the full brunt of its power and a degree of social control, which is unimaginable to us in the West. Imagine quarantining 50 million people, locking down entire cities. This is both probably over the top from a medical standpoint and a demonstration to the people of China and the world about how ruthless the government of China can be. Most of the epidemiologists that Asia Times has consulted do not think that holding people in place is necessarily the best way to control an epidemic. I think rather the Communist Party is showing, let's show the world what total control we have and what degree of ruthlessness we can employ. And I think they made that demonstration very effectively.
You know, I heard a report this morning on National Public Radio that was particularly chilling in this regard, David. I don't know if you caught it, but it was recounting the steps that are now being taken, I think in Wuhan specifically, but probably elsewhere as well, where this ruthless Chinese Communist Party is essentially forcibly moving people into quarantine centers. And these are fairly primitive holding pens, basically. And one of those whose family members were being confined to it basically said, this is where they take you to die. That does not seem as though it will conduce to morale rising among the Chinese people. And if anything, as you say, this is likely to breed, it would seem to me, a really intensifying hostility towards the party and the regime it runs. No?
Well, to the extent that's a possibility, I think that the Xi Jinping government decided to preempt it by showing the iron fist under the velvet glove and intimidating people. To what extent it'll succeed, we shall see. It's also remarked by many epidemiologists that it's impressive how fast the Chinese moved to crack the genetic code of the virus, post it, and get people working on a cure, or at least a vaccine. So Chinese medicine and Chinese biotechnology has also been impressive in this. Both their ruthlessness and their capacity have shown themselves. Now, how bad this will be, we don't know. The Economist speculated that there are probably many more cases that haven't been reported, which suggests that in many cases, the virus may be no more unpleasant than a flu. So it may not have a high fatality rate. We simply don't know. It's out of my area, but I think we've seen how ruthless and effective China can be when it wants to flex its muscles and show its political power. It's impressive and frightening.
And I wonder to what extent, David, are the instruments of totalitarian control that the Chinese have been putting into place with the help of companies like Hikvision that is underwritten by American capital markets and investors, by the way, to not only effect this, what they call social credit system, but also to, you know, crack down on the Chinese people, perhaps in this manner.
Well, given the fact the Chinese government can tell where every single person is in the country at all times, whom they're talking to, what they're posting on social media, what they're spending money on, and correlate all of these things, that's certainly an advantage when you're dealing with an epidemic. A cruel and frightening advantage, but it's there.
We did a poll, David, I don't know if you've seen it. The Committee on the Present Danger China sponsored it and asked some questions specifically along these lines about American likely voters' attitudes towards this social credit system. Many of them didn't know much about it, but as they got some information in the course of the polling, responded as one would expect them to do, with some horror, I think it's fair to say, at what this kind of Orwellian system on steroids is capable of. And I think what you're describing in terms of how it's being employed at the moment is only going to reinforce that point. David, do you credit the suspicions that some have, and I must say I'm among them, that this may have had something to do, we're not quite clear what and the extent, but something to do with a covert and illegal biological weapons program in China?
I have no information about that. I consider that speculation. There are lots of other ways viruses can pop up apart from weapons labs.
Let me ask you, David, if I could, about, again, this issue of how does a government weather the kind of backlash that is likely to happen as a result of all of this? And does its control of the sources of information and the means of communication, notably through this company that you're studying closely, Huawei, give it an additional advantage above and beyond this social credit system and its technologies to essentially deny people the ability to both know fully what's going on around them and communicate with one another about it?
There are limits to how far that can go. There is social media in China. The West learned about the epidemic actually through social media posts in advance of the public announcement. There were a number of consulting firms who look at Chinese social media who were aware of it close to a week in advance. The outrage over the death of a Chinese physician who had warned about the coronavirus, in fact, himself died of it, is something that popped out in social media. So anything this big is something no government can entirely suppress information about, no matter how much they set to the social media. I think that the Xi Jinping government will take a hit in terms of popular outrage. I very much doubt it will be overthrown by the epidemic. Its response has been to show its ruthlessness, and we'll see what the outcome is. I wouldn't hold my breath and wait for the Chinese government to fold just yet.
No, I don't think just yet, perhaps, but it is interesting. I've been told by students of the matter that other dynasties have fallen as a result of plague and pestilence and the like. To your upcoming project of the book on Huawei, give us just the quickest of updates, if you could, David, on how the United States is doing in trying to bring forth an alternative to the products that Huawei has on offer in the 5G realm.
What DARPA and the White House have talked about is a software-based approach which would basically enhance the existing networks. And instead of buying a ton of switches from the Chinese or the Swedes or the Finns, would use what's called a virtual network to try to move the switches into the cloud. This is, from the industry experts I've talked to, as good points and bad points. The good points is, in theory, this could work as an alternative to the kind of distributed system that Huawei is selling. The bad point is it would take us 4 or 5 years. Now, 4 or 5 years from now, I spoke to senior people at Huawei and asked them what they thought about it. And they said, well, you know, let the United States do that. China's network will be completely built out in 2 or 3 years. Europe's will be built out in about 3 years with our equipment, and Huawei is now building plants in Europe to manufacture its equipment there. To the extent the Europeans complain about security problems, Huawei said, well, you guys make it in your home countries. You set the standards, so you're comfortable with it. And the key thing is that all the spin-off technology, the applications to manufacturing, autonomous vehicles, healthcare, mining, goes on forever, will already be well underway outside the United States before we get this thing up and running.
By the time they may even be on to 6G, no? It's a whole other world 5 or 6 years from now.
Well, that's yet another issue, which is not quite a glint in the eye of the Trump administration, as far as I'm aware. People talk about it, but the only thing that's come up is a significant proposal with the virtual networks. That's the status of it. I think it's certainly a step to respond, but I don't think it solves our problem quite yet.
Too little, too late, perhaps. David Goldman, we are anxiously awaiting the publication of your book on the subject and the chance to visit with you at length about that. Come back to us again soon, though. In the meantime, be well, my friend. It's good to have you with us, as always. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next week, Monday. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.